This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a recent Amnesty International study on the sexual violence against Indigenous women in the United States.
One out of every three Native American women will in their lifetime be subject to sexual violence, and yet little or nothing is done about it.
We'll also take a look at what has changed for conscientious objectors since the Vietnam War. We'll speak with Todd Ensign, lawyer and director of Citizen Soldier.
They're still soldiers who go to Iraq, and after they see what they see, they say, "I don't any longer want to go to war, anywhere, at any time." Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
More than one in three Native American or Alaskan Native women will be raped at some point in their lives. Most do not seek justice because they know they'll be met with inaction or indifference. Over the course of 2 years, Amnesty International researched sexual violence against Native American women. The recently published report, Maze of Injustice, The Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the U.S., unravels some of the reasons why Indigenous women in the U.S. are at such high risk of sexual violence and why survivors can't get the justice that they seek. With us today is Michael Heflin, director of the Campaigns Program at Amnesty International. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what the report uncovered.
Well, the report looked at this issue from many different angles, and what the report found was that there is very high rate of violence, sexual violence against Native American women. As you stated in your introduction, our report and our interviews with survivors of sexual violence, with support workers, with law enforcement officials, indicated that those rates are extremely high, 2.5 times higher than for women in the U.S. population in general. And again, as you stated in the introduction, one in three Native American women or Alaska Native women are likely to experience rape at some point in their lifetime. You know,
as I understand it, it's one in eight women who are raped in the U.S. among the general population. Why the significant difference?
Well, our report looked at that question, and what we found is that there are a multitude of reasons why Native American and Alaska Native women experience sexual violence at such high rates. One of the interesting findings of our report is that, and again, this is consistent with other studies that have been done, that it's the one demographic group in the United States where the majority of perpetrators of sexual violence are not from the same demographic group. So the majority of the survivors that we interviewed told us that the perpetrator of sexual violence against them was non-Native. And we looked at, you know, why that was the case. And, you know, we think very much, and we concluded that it links to historic violence against Native American people and discrimination against Native American people. And if you look at this issue historically, I mean, this is not a new problem. And this is rape and sexual violence against Native American women was used as a tool of oppression throughout the period when Native American people were displaced from their territory, from their land. And so this is a historic problem. Some of the contemporary factors that contribute to the problem is what we describe in the report as a jurisdictional maze. And what has happened is that over the years, a complex set of court decisions and also statutes that have been passed have created this situation where when Native American women experience sexual violence, one of the first problems that they experience is even figuring out who has jurisdiction to investigate the crime at the police level and then to prosecute the crime once an investigation has been carried out. And this is really a serious problem. The problem manifests itself differently in different parts of the country. One of the states that we looked at very closely was the state of Oklahoma. And the state of Oklahoma is interestingly not a state that had a large Native American population originally, but a lot of Native American people were relocated there in the 19th century. The state now is a patchwork of state and tribal lands. And what happens is that even when the police respond to crime of sexual violence, there's often a big debate among the different police authorities, the tribal police and the state police, as to who has jurisdiction. It's often very difficult to figure out even if the land is tribal land or state land. And that's just at the investigation level. And then once there is some minimal investigation done, trying to get the case prosecuted, similarly comes this whole issue of who has jurisdiction and who should prosecute the case.
I've seen that even with speeding tickets on reservation land.
Absolutely.
That they fight over who should get to prosecute the speeding ticket. But the sovereignty issue for Native Americans is a very big one, and so they're not necessarily willing to let the state come in on that issue. I guess that's a big issue, as you're saying here.
That is an issue, the sovereignty issue, which is not an issue that we go into a lot of depth in the report, except to say that tribal governments have been recognized by the U.S. government as sovereign nations and as a result ought to have the authority to prosecute crimes which take place on tribal land. And currently, there are three factors that essentially decide who has jurisdiction. And those include who the perpetrator is, you know, whether the perpetrator is a Native American or non-Native person, who the victim is, and where the crime takes place. Again, it gets very complex to try to figure this out in individual cases often. And then related to the question of who's the perpetrator and who the victim is, under current law, tribal governments don't have the authority to prosecute non-Native perpetrators. So even though a majority of the perpetrators, you know, it's indicated from our report and other studies, are non-Native, tribal courts can't actually.
Well, that's really interesting to me, because to the extent I spend time on Indian reservations, which I do on occasion, is the amount of dislike and racism involved in people outside the reservation toward Indian peoples or Native American peoples is extraordinary. So to imagine, just I'm sitting here imagining a Native American woman going into a non-Native American court and probably being treated in terms of testimony like a black person was treated during Jim Crow or even in slavery, with probably not believing her at all. So I don't know if that's an issue, but it would seem to me that the amount of racism toward Native Americans in those states is extraordinary. So I just imagine in the courts that's...
Sure, and that's consistent with some of the testimonies that we receive from women who are survivors, that they were often... Prosecutors would try to suggest, or defense attorneys would try to suggest that there was alcohol involved. So there was all these kinds of historic prejudices and notions about Native American women that that played into the way that these cases were handled.
Can you tell us about some of the stories that you investigated?
Absolutely. One of the cases one of the testimonies that I remember, you know, very clearly from the Standing Rock Reservation is we were talking to this woman who's a survivor of sexual violence herself and now an advocate, and, you know, asked her what the incident rate was in your community. And she said that she didn't know any women in her community, in the village that she lived in, that had not experienced sexual violence sometime in their life. And you know, when we talked to other women, you know, this very much seemed to be the way that these women, similar to the experience of other women as well.
I just wanted to remind our listeners, if they've just tuned in, we're speaking with Michael Heflin from Amnesty International, who's just done a wonderful service, I think, in getting the facts out about sexual violence against Native American women. Michael, tell us, where did you go to do these interviews? How were these stories accumulated? And what kind of conclusions did you draw from your work?
Absolutely. The report is national in scope, but we did detailed research in 2005 and 2006 in three locations. One location was Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which is a reservation that covers 2.3 million acres in South and North Dakota, so a very large reservation. The second location was the state of Oklahoma, which I talked a little bit about earlier. And the third location was the state of Alaska. And we chose the three locations because they each represent very different situations. I mean, Alaska is a complicated situation because you have many Alaska Native villages which are not even accessible by roads. There's a very serious problem of under-resourcing of law enforcement, really any ability to respond when women are victims of sexual violence. In Oklahoma, you have the situation where you don't have a large reservation similar to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Instead, what you have is a patchwork of state and tribal land, which, you know, further complicates the jurisdictional issues that I was talking about earlier. And then Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is this vast area, again, where one of the key problems was just under-resourcing of the law enforcement capacity to actually deal with the problem. Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, as I mentioned, is 2.3 million acres. There are six police officers in the Standing Rock Police Department who are responsible for policing this entire 2.3 million acres. And so as a result, it often takes hours or even days for a police officer to respond to an incident of sexual violence against a woman on the reservation.
What kind of conclusions did you draw from the study?
We drew a number of conclusions. I mean, one was steps need to be taken to deal with the jurisdictional problems. And some of them are very complicated as they result from the Indian Civil Rights Act going back to 1968, also from a Supreme Court decision called the Oliphant decision, which restricted the right of tribal nations to prosecute perpetrators who are non-native. We do believe that these jurisdictional issues need to be dealt with. Dealing with them is going to be complicated, probably a long-term kind of effort. But there are short-term things that can be done. On the positive side, one of the things that we found was that in some cases, state police and local police and tribal police had worked out agreements so that they could pursue individual perpetrators when they crossed the borders between tribes and state territory. And we found that when these were entered into in a relationship of mutual respect, that these were often very effective in at least being able to pursue perpetrators and to investigate the crimes. One of the other really important findings that we found, which sort of moves away from law enforcement, is really, again, the under-resourcing of health services for Native American women in particular, but Native American people in general. And what that means with respect to this issue is that most Indian health service facilities in this country don't have adequately trained personnel who can deal with cases of sexual assault. So, for example, many IHS facilities don't have any trained sexual assault nurse examiners on staff, or maybe they only have one who obviously isn't working 24 hours. And so when someone comes in to report that kind of crime, there often isn't anyone available to do a rape test and to gather the evidence that would be needed ultimately to prosecute the crime or to provide the very, very basic kind of support the woman needs, you know, as a result of having been the victim of sexual violence.
So then what happens? That evidence isn't collected, that woman receives no support?
Often the evidence is just not collected. In some cases, there is an effort made by the woman herself or her family to try to get her someplace where they can actually conduct a sexual assault examination. Sometimes that means that she has to travel, you know, 100 or 75 miles from where the incident actually took place. Sometimes, of course, then that's a deterrent to anything happening because there's a cost. You know, one of the other realities, of course, is that the very high poverty rate among Native American people. And so once you create these kinds of, you know, structural barriers to people being able to even get a rape test taken, you know, it means that many women will not pursue the test and as a result will not have the evidence that they need to prosecute the case.
We're speaking with Michael Heflin, Campaigns Director of Amnesty International, and he's with us to discuss the latest report, Maze of Injustice, that talks about Native American women and abuse. We're also joined on the phone by Jesqua Burnett. She's a counselor for the Oto Missouria tribe in Oklahoma. She has a long history of working on domestic abuse and sexual assault of Native women, including in Canada and the U.S. Jesqua, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the problem of sexual assault of Native American women.
The problems with jurisdiction, with lack of police education and support, with the cross-jurisdictional boundaries mostly, and then, of course, the actual treatment of women. There are very, very few sane nurses, sexual assault nurse examiners in our area, and the ones that are in a community at least 20-some miles away. We've got many women who don't report. Since this report has come out and there's been a lot more discussion, I've had many, many women approach me and say that they have been sexually assaulted more than one time and have never reported those crimes.
And why do they say they never report?
Distrust of the police, perhaps. If they've called before on something else and the police haven't responded, or if they're perhaps someone who is known to the police, or they know of someone that they don't feel that the police did anything for. Now, that's not saying that the police do absolutely nothing ever. It's people's perceptions of what is done and what can be done. And women in this area certainly do not feel like they're supported in the court system, and certainly the court system the way it sits now, because if something happens on tribal land by a non-Indian, the likelihood of anything being done is about nil.
Why is that?
Well, for instance, if you have a non-native on Indian land sexually assaulting a native woman, the BIA has jurisdiction over that.
The BIA is the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
Yes, thank you. The tribal police, the court systems don't really go up into that kind of a crime. They're not allowed to prosecute that kind of a crime, and they have to call in the Bureau of Indian Affairs police.
One of the stories that the report highlights is that of Jamie Rozelle. It says that she's a Cherokee woman living in Oklahoma, and she decided to seek prosecution 5 months after she was raped on state land in 2003. After attending a preliminary hearing, it was revealed that her sexual assault forensic examination, including the sexual assault nurse examiner's report, photographs, and the clothing she had been wearing, had all been destroyed. She was told by the police department that the evidence had been destroyed as a routine part of the cleaning of their storage of evidence room because she had initially declined to press charges. Because the evidence was destroyed, the DA advised her to drop the complaint. How common are incidents like this? I don't think we would ever really accept this in a mainstream white community.
It's so common, it's ridiculous. That's just a common occurrence. It's a very common occurrence. I don't honestly believe that that's a matter of, you know, it's an attitude. It's an attitude of, well, she didn't want to report it then, let's just junk this. You know, there's no encouragement for a woman to report. And I think the thing that gets me is that this becomes the woman's case against the offender. That's not how this is. It's a misconception. It is not the woman's case. It is the court's case. It's the state's case, or it's the tribal court's case, or it's the federal case. It is not the woman's case. It does not belong to her.
That's something that's not commonly understood. When there has been a murder, when there has been a rape, when there has been an assault, it is considered a crime against the state, in addition to being a crime against the person, and that's why you have the state prosecuting. So thank you for making that point.
Well, and the thing that grabs me about this is, from a healing point of view, when I hear a woman say, my rape case, when she has no control over that rape case, from a healing point of view, that's very difficult, because if that case goes nowhere, if that person is never found, if he's never charged, and if he's never convicted, then there's a feeling of failure right away, you know, a continuous feeling of failure for many years. This isn't something like TV that gets done in an hour.
Okay. We're speaking with Jasqua Burnett, who's a counselor for Native American women in Oklahoma. Jessica, I wanted to ask you this. Were these women who were raped, were they raped by people they had previously known, or were there strangers that came onto the reservation, or both? I mean, what is exactly the situation there?
I'd say the majority of rape cases are by acquaintances, mostly acquaintance rape. Party, relationships, friends, just, you know, a misplaced trust, perhaps. Alcohol doesn't take part in all of them. I just worked with one this last weekend that alcohol didn't have anything to do with, and it was on tribal land by a non-native.
Is there a sense that it's somehow less serious when the perpetrator knows the victim?
Yes, there's certainly that. There's always the question, I've heard this time and time again, well, what did you do to create that situation? Why did you put yourself there?
Yeah, well, they make the victim into the criminal.
Right.
But
yeah.
It seems to me also that the non-native perpetrators of rape seem to have some kind of sense of entitlement that they can just do this.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the case. And it's becoming more and more common, because more and more non-native men who have this attitude are coming onto the res and targeting Indian women.
Especially if they know there's no consequences or no serious consequences.
Yep.
And it just, as I said earlier, it just reminds you of, you know, the way African Americans were treated for years, mm-hmm. particularly during Jim Crow period and obviously slavery.
Right.
One of the interesting excerpts from the report was from Kevin Grover, who was at the time, he said this, the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Interior. And he said this at the 175th anniversary of the establishment of the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in September 2001. This is an excerpt from his speech. Mm-hmm. As the nation looked to the West for more land, this agency participated in the ethnic cleansing that befell the Western tribes. It must be acknowledged that the deliberate spread of disease and the cowardly killing of women and children made for tragedy on a scale so ghastly that it cannot be dismissed as merely the inevitable consequence of the clash of competing ways of life.
Mm-hmm.
After the devastation of tribal economies and the deliberate creation of tribal dependence on the services provided by this agency, the agency set out to destroy all things Indian. This agency forbade the speaking of Indian languages, prohibited the conduct of traditional religious activities, outlawed traditional government, and made Indian people ashamed of who they were. Worst of all, the Bureau of Indian Affairs committed these acts against the children entrusted to its boarding schools, brutalizing them emotionally, psychologically, physically, and spiritually. The legacy of these misdeeds haunts us. Can you tell us a little bit about how, elaborate more on how the history plays into the current situation?
Well, what we have, I believe, is intergenerational abuse. And his statement is entirely correct and very powerful. What he doesn't say explicitly is the sexual abuse that was perpetrated there. When you take children away, and I use this often as an example, if you set up people who have children that are 5 and 6 years old and you say to them, your children are going to be removed tomorrow and they are going to go away to school long, far away that you can't get to them, and we are going to recreate them or assimilate them, basically, it's a horror story. Exactly what he said happened. Their hair was cut, which is a very important thing to Indian people, male and female. They could not speak their language. They couldn't speak to their siblings. They were turned into little robots wearing exactly the same clothing, punished severely. And then when they were 16 or 17 years old, graduated from this boarding school, maybe they could read and write, but with no real skills except for maybe sewing and farming, and put back onto the reservation or onto the tribal lands, where they found their family, their parents, had turned to alcohol, a tremendous amount of alcoholism. Now you have these children who don't know their parents, have no real relationship with their parents, have never been parented, back onto the res, and the cycle continues. And it continues for many generations. And this hasn't just stopped in the last 100 years. This has just been within the last 25 years that the last boarding school was closed. You've got an intergenerational abuse of people who were never allowed to be parents, people who don't know how to be parents, having children, and now parenting those children. We've lost a tremendous amount of leadership from our elders because of it. Luckily, there were elders, or people that didn't actually go to the school, so we still have a lot of things to fall back on with our elders. But the tremendous amount of intergenerational abuse is just, it's horrifying.
How widespread was it that children would be taken from their parents and sent to boarding schools?
I think it was all over the United States. It was certainly all over Canada.
It was all over Canada. And, of course, there's a movie that you probably have seen called Rabbit Proof Fence, mm-hmm. which, of course, is about Australian children, Aboriginal children, Native Americans of Native Australians who were taken into these kind of schools as well.
And the shocking thing about that movie is we learned that it just recently been abolished, and it's doubly shocking to learn from you, Jesqua, that the boarding schools here in the United States lasted all the way up to just 25 years ago.
I didn't realize it was a Canadian issue as well.
No,
I know you're a Canadian Cree, but I didn't realize it happened in Canada.
Oh, it was terrible in Canada, and no less worse here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it means for both women, a woman who's been raped, and what it means for a community when someone has been raped or there's been this horrible crime perpetrated against someone and there's no legal recourse?
Well, I think it makes the women bitter, certainly mistrusting. It's hard to explain to a lot of people that that is a crime. It's not a crime of sex. It's not a sexual behavior. It is a crime of assault. and have them understand that this is a severe assault. The women feel like nobody really supports them, nobody believes them, and that everybody wants them to just forget it and continue. And it's a very difficult thing. It creates mistrust in all sorts. Your life completely changes. And when you live in a small community like this, your life has changed and you become, you know, angry. You become more introverted. You become more distrustful. And the depression is just immense.
I'm just interested in what your next steps are for both of you, what you see as the next steps that both our listeners can look at some more and get some more information, as well as what your goals are. And Michael, if you could go first.
Certainly.
On that.
Well, on a very basic level, one of the things that we're hoping to achieve with this report is to raise the visibility of the issue in the U.S. public in general, and also even internationally. I mean, we're a global human rights organization and are distributing this report throughout the world, and we have actually produced it in four languages, English, Spanish, French, and Arabic. And so to raise the visibility of this issue, to get people to understand that this is a human rights issue. You know, it's not just a question of, you know, law enforcement or public health issue. I mean, it obviously connects to those issues, but this is a human rights issue. The U.S. government and the state governments that are involved and the tribal governments have a responsibility under international human rights standards to not only not directly commit human rights abuses themselves, but also to protect people from human rights abuses and to really raise the profile of that obligation and to make sure that steps are taken. It is a complex problem, as I described earlier, but we think some immediate steps can be taken to deal with the problem. One of the first things that we called for with the launch of our report a few weeks ago was for full funding for a piece of legislation called the Stop Violence Against Women Act, which was originally passed in the 1990s, reauthorized in 2005. And when it was reauthorized in 2005, it included for the first time, as a result of the strong advocacy of Native American and Alaska Native women, a tribal title. And that tribal title would actually require the U.S. government to do a number of things that would begin to address this problem. It would ask the Attorney General to conduct an evaluation of the jurisdictional issues. It would ask the Department of Health and Human Services to look at the health issues and the funding issues needed to make sure that women survivors are given the kind of health services that they need. It would require that a registry be established, a tribal registry, so that perpetrators of sexual violence against Native American women could be tracked. These are really important first steps. So we're really pushing that that legislation and the tribal title in particular be fully funded. We've also asked for the Indian Health Services to receive additional funding so that they will have a greater capacity to deal with this issue, and also that an Indian Health Service facilities standard protocols be adopted at all of those facilities on dealing with cases of sexual assault, and that include training personnel so that there are more personnel trained, there are more sexual assault nurse examiners trained who can make sure that the rape tests are conducted and make sure that women get the support that they need.
Thank you, Michael. And just any additional material you want to bring to our listeners' attention?
Well, I think he really just covered everything. Those are the things that I would certainly wish for. Is it difficult to get protocols established, and it's certainly more difficult when we don't have the information about how serious this is out here. Now we do. I mean, I think we all knew, but when you see it in black and white and in writing and you hear the stories and realize it's not just this area, it has a completely different impact. I know that this tribal council completely supports this and are trying to find funding to assist this tribe and other tribes in this area, because there are, you know, 7-8 tribes in this, right in this local area. It's a big problem. It's a big concern, and we do need that funding, and we do need it down into the more into the grassroots and not up into the research end.
Is there someone that you've worked with any time in your history as a victim advocate that you really remember?
There was a woman several years ago, actually, who was in argument with her. They were on tribal land. Her and her non-native husband were on tribal land. They were having a big argument, and the police were called. And she had had a few drinks, and he had also, but he was more sober. And the police let him drive off, put her in the vehicle, said she was either going to go to jail or go home. He said he'd take her home, sort of rolled her into the vehicle, and he took her home, which was a fairly remote area. And within 3 or 4 hours, she had actually killed him when he came at her, and it was after a rape. After sexual assault, he'd sexually assaulted her prior to the police showing up, and he sexually assaulted her again when he got home, and when he came after her a third time, she shot him. And I really feel like we really dropped the ball.
It seems like we dropped the ball in a lot of places here. There are a lot of stories like this in the report, Maze of Injustice, The Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the USA. Michael Heflin, where can we get the report, or where can readers take a look at the report?
Well, the easiest way to get a copy of the report is actually to go to the Amnesty International USA website, which is www.amnestyusa.org. There's a special section on the website that deals with this report. It's connected to a larger campaign called our Stop Violence Against Women campaign, which is a global six-year campaign. But on the website, they can download a copy of the report. There's also information if they want to order a hard copy of the report. They can get information to order a hard copy. There's also additional resources. There's a slideshow that they can look at that shows different women advocates who are working on this issue around the country. I would say one of the most hopeful things from working on this report is that there are really phenomenal advocates like Jesqua all around the country who are really doing terrific work, and we can do something about this problem. It's one of the messages that we want to get across clearly, and you know, we're hoping to raise the visibility and give them a platform to even have greater success in the work that they're doing.
And there's opportunities to take action on that page.
And there's direct opportunities to take action on that page.
Michael Heflin from Amnesty International and Jesqua Burnett, counselor for the Oto Missouria Tribe in Oklahoma. Thank you for joining us, both of you, on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As our listeners know, for a long time, we've been covering the issue of resistance to the Iraq War, particularly by military resistors and conscientious objectors. We've interviewed many war resistors and their families and discussed conscientious objection. We've also looked at how legislation has changed for soldiers who are applying for conscientious objector status. Today, we're happy to have with us Todd Enzine, who has for many years been the head of Citizen Soldier, a terrific, wonderful grassroots group that helps people, soldiers, military, etc., who are trying not to go to illegal wars. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Todd Enzine.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Hi, Todd. Michael Smith here. I just want to tell our listeners, I was doing military law back in Detroit 40 years ago in 67, and so were you, and you're still doing it. And we really admire your work.
Thank you. It's one of these problems that actually, if anything, has grown larger, not smaller, over all those years.
That's pretty depressing, considering
how bad it was then.
That's right.
Considering that after Vietnam, we actually thought there was some hope.
I did, too, but I'll tell you, it just has come surging back, as you all know.
You've been through a lot of wars that this country, I guess it's permanent war, so you have a permanent job in some way. Mm-hmm. But in the current environment, Have you seen a lot of resistance to this war among enlisted men, among officers, among young people?
Well, it's interesting. This is a good time to talk about it, because until about a year ago, the Pentagon was claiming that there was not an uptick. There was not an increase in desertions, for example, if you accept their figures as, you know, somewhat accurate. That seemed to be the case, that the 3 years before that we invaded Iraq had higher desertion rates than the 3 years after. However, this last year, there's been a pretty substantial increase in the number of desertions, and I would say it's increased by at least 50%. So that would suggest that, you know, soldiers to some extent are voting with their feet. Now, of course, the military always says, well, you know, a lot of deserters are driven by family problems or, you know, financial issues, or they just can't stomach the military, which, of course, is true in some cases. But I do think there is an increase in the attitude among soldiers, especially guys that have already served over there, that this is an endless war and there's nothing to be gained by them going back again.
Is there an organization of former soldiers from Iraq who are trying to resist the continuation of the war?
Yes, there is. It's called IVAW, Iraq Vets Against War. They were formed about 2.5 years ago now, and they have been growing, I would say slowly, but they are growing, and they've gained, in fact, I'm glad to say we've got a chapter of IVAW up at Fort Drum, which is where we have our coffee house, and that's the first on-base chapter of IVAW that I'm aware of. So
where is that?
Fort Drum is about 60 miles straight north of Syracuse, almost to the Canadian border. And most New Yorkers know it as a reserve base. However, under Reagan, it was turned very much into an active infantry base. Now it's the most heavily deployed division in the U.S. Army. It's a very active combat infantry base.
Wait, can you explain for people who don't know what the coffee house is and how it came about?
Good question. During the Vietnam War, those of us who are older in the older generation recall there were over 20 coffee houses that were formed mostly by civilians initially at or near U.S. military bases, Army and Marine bases, and Navy and Air Force, too. And these were very important in building the GI movement and building the opposition to the Vietnam War within the ranks. They had an enormous impact. There's a very fine documentary called Sir, No Sir that some of you listeners have probably seen that tells that story. And it's really pretty amazing to realize that those coffee houses were often largely run and staffed by soldiers, active duty soldiers. And so it was a very exciting time. And so we, in a way, we've taken a leaf from that book. We're trying to replicate some of that. However, we have to realize that this is a very different military. This is an all-volunteer force. There's no draft. And so the military no longer represents a cross-section of the society.
I want to remind our listeners we're talking to Todd Enzine. He's a lawyer and the director of Citizen Soldier, a support organization for GIs.
You were saying that the military no longer represents a cross-section of our society. What
right.
does it represent?
It pretty much draws all its membership enlistments from working-class families and from poor families, families that aren't even in the economy now. So they recruit heavily in inner-city areas. They recruit in the Northeast and the Middle West, where, like, the state that I'm from and some Mike's from, has lost 120,000 jobs in the last 7 years. I'm talking about Michigan. So those young people coming out of working families today, they can't look about going into the plants, going in to get a good job, a good pension. Those days are gone. And so the military, that's why they're able to meet their enlistment quotas, even though this war is so horrible and it forces people to do two or three tours in a combat zone, which is worse than Vietnam. And yet they can get the numbers because they pay them big bonuses. And it really, in a way, has become much more of a mercenary army.
I was reading Camilla Mejia's great book, mm-hmm. The Road from Al-Ramadi. And in it, I think it's at the end of the first or second chapter, he talks about how he was looking forward to getting out of the army. It was only a couple months away. I think it was coming June 2003 when he was told that stop loss had been put into effect, in essence, holding him there until the year 2031.
As I understand stop loss, you can only keep someone on active duty involuntarily for a 12-month period. But as I don't know exactly what he means. But there's no question today, like, for example, at the coffee house, we're representing a couple soldiers that don't want to redeploy. One of them only has 3 months left on his contract at the time they send him back to Iraq. They will keep him there the other 12 months in stop-loss status. In other words, they know before they send him that he's not eligible really under his enlistment contract. That's very common. They do that to thousands of people, and I recall that the Center for Constitutional Rights a couple years ago filed a lawsuit against this. And this is a really heavy, I mean, it has to be called involuntary servitude.
You're just telling fraud.
You're just telling someone your contract's up, too bad. We'll keep you another year. And kids go over there under that program and are killed or maimed. I mean, it's terrible.
No, it's really thousands of people it's happening to.
Exactly.
We haven't really been that successful in the court so far, but it's still being litigated at different places around
the
country.
That's good to hear. But they take kids every day right out of Fort Drum and send them over there, even though, that just like Camillo, they know that their contract will expire while they're in the war zone. And that probably leads us to something else, and that's the way they handle conscientious objector claims now. It used to be that folks who were had filed a valid claim were kept from being sent to a war zone because there is a regulation that says your assignment should minimally conflict with your stated beliefs. That's a regulation in their own code. But they now today take kids that have filed claims and send them to Iraq or to Afghanistan, and they have hearings over there.
So in other words, let's say you're a person who is, obviously, because it's voluntary, you've joined the military.
Right.
And then you've decided that you have a conscientious objection and it has to be to all war. Is that right?
Right, that's right.
You file that claim, and then while the claim is pending, they say, well, we're going to send you over to Iraq to adjudicate or decide that claim. Is that right?
That is exactly right. In fact, we have two cases at Drum that look like they're going to exactly evolve in that way. File the claim here in August. The unit is shipped. They go with the unit, and then supposedly you're going to have some kind of hearing in Iraq, which, you know, it's really a clear denial of all your rights because you have a right, for example, to call witnesses.
Well,
you have
exactly.
a right to have a civilian lawyer there. Obviously, none of those rights can be respected in a war zone.
Also, what happens with your other people who are shipped over with? They can't be too happy with having a conscientious objector among them. It must be pretty uncomfortable
for
the guy.
Well, it could even be dangerous, one could say. It could be dangerous to be in a war zone with people with loaded weapons. And they see you as almost a traitor in some cases.
Can you give us some sense of the numbers? The numbers that filed CO or conscientious objection?
They're pretty low.
The Vietnam War and now to the Iraq War. How would you compare the two?
There's really not any comparison. And I don't know the exact numbers for the Vietnam War, but they were in the thousands per year, that I know. And even in the period, say, after the first Gulf War, I know there was over 1,000, 1,200 CO applications filed a year, most of which in that period were successful. About 75-80% of them then were successful. I think the latest figure I saw is last year there was something little over 100 claims filed in the whole military.
Now let me ask about
in the
Army,
I should say.
Let me ask you, Todd, about the difference in treatment. When you did it during Vietnam, they wouldn't then ship you over to Vietnam, is that right?
That was the general practice. Once you filed a claim, they would not put you in a combat zone or give you combat duties. Now, or they'd sign you to the hospital, they'd sign you to clerical work. Now with this war, it is much harsher treatment of people, and there have been hearings that have been held. Well, Camilo Mejia, let's take his case. After he was convicted of desertion, in other words, we filed a CO claim, they still went ahead with a desertion prosecution. They convicted him, and we had the CO hearing in Fort Sill prison.
Where's Fort Sill?
That's in Oklahoma. And so he's sitting in prison when we finally have a CO claim adjudicated.
And what happened in the CO
and in
claim?
In his case, it was pretty flagrant. The hearing examiner recommended he be denied because the hearing officer said he is an objector to a particular war. And as you said, that's not permitted. However, that really wasn't the case. Camillo talked about the Iraq War because that's the war he fought in. But he was opposed to all wars. He was clearly a conscientious objector. They denied it. And the only recourse then is there's an administrative panel within the Pentagon that you can appeal to. And then in some cases, these cases have gone into federal court. And in a few of those federal court cases, they've been won on appeal. But in Camillo's case, the resources weren't there to do that. So he basically was just flatly denied, I think against all rules, his claim. But the point is that he had the claim adjudicated after he'd been convicted to a year in prison.
Let me ask you, this seems to be an issue I'm sure that has come up a lot. Now, these people voluntarily, so-called, joined the military.
Right.
They then, many of them actually maybe were over in Iraq and saw what happened and decided to be COs.
Right.
And so the argument that they object to all war
is hard for them to make, I imagine. Is that right?
Well, I think that's what he used in Camillo's case. He said, look, everything he writes in his documents and his papers and statements is about the Iraq War. But the point is, of course he'd write about that. That's the war he fought. Why wouldn't he write about the Iraq War? You know, what changed his mind? Shooting at civilians, shooting at people at roadblocks, that kind of thing. He was involved in abuse of detainees. Those things affected his decision to become a CO, but of course he's going to talk about what he knows. But see, the CO hearing officer uses that as evidence that he's just a specific war objector, see.
But so, also, I think Michael's point also spoke to the fact that people have a hard time understanding why someone would enlist in the military and then say that they're opposed to all wars.
Yeah, but that's true. But you know, in fact, when you sign an enlistment contract, there's a section on there where you say, I am not a CO. And you have to initial that.
Really?
Yes. So when you go in, you are saying, I am not a CO. But the simple fact is that these are 18, 17, 19-year-old kids who don't know anything about what it means to have a shot, shoot people, and have people shoot at you. They don't have any understanding of their moral. They have no moral thinking about any of that. And the military should recognize. By the way, you know, people think that the CO thing was enshrined by the Supreme Court back in the Seeger case when they said you don't have to be an adherent to an organized religion in order to be a CO. You just have to have deeply held moral beliefs. The fact is, in that case, the Supreme Court said that if the military didn't want to confer CO status, they didn't have to.
What do you mean, that it's not required by our law?
The First Amendment, they seem to be saying, does not require them to recognize the right of someone to be a CO.
So they could dispense with CO altogether.
They could. But, see, I think in peacetime, it's a kind of a good safety valve for them. It allows them to appear sort of reasonable. It's not that many people, and they can process it.
So I got a question for you,
sure, sir.
Todd. Who said this? I'm against every war except a class war.
Eugene Debs.
Right. Send him
a
cookie.
He went to prison for counseling people not to go to war, which is nothing but his free speech right. That was pretty incredible. Yeah, well, those are we don't have leaders like Eugene today.
A related question to Eugene Debs. How far can you go in counseling people around war? Is there a place that the government, not you, but that the government still thinks you cross a line into whatever the crime is?
Well, there is, of course, you know, as there always is, an aiding and abetting statute. And I think I always tell families...
Aiding and abetting what?
Aiding and abetting desertion.
Okay.
So I always tell families, they call and they say, well, what can we do? And I say, I think there's a fine line there. You know, if you're handing someone money to help them desert, you are, you know, perhaps crossing a legal line about complicity. As far as CO counseling, I have never heard of a counseling group or a lawyer being charged or threatened with charges for CO counseling. But, you know, if it became, here's what I've always seen about the military. Right now, they're leaving our coffee house alone. They're not harassing us up there. They don't send in people. They don't break our windows. They haven't put out a banning order on the base, you know, making us off limits. They could do those things. They haven't. And I think it's because so far we haven't had that much traction. We start at really affecting the unit deployability and start making people stand, you know, and resist in different ways. I think you would probably see them come in, because we've seen that with the whole Bush.
But let me ask you, what if you did things like Debs did? And, you know, he did a thing about class, but what if you put up big signs on the coffee house, don't go to Iraq war, it's an illegal war, you're committing a war crime. Or, you know, if you this war is representative of all wars, apply for CO. What if you went out with either of those kinds of signs?
Oh, that, well, I don't think anything would happen in the short term. In a sense, we do say that because our bookshelves, as you would imagine, are filled with books and tracts of all kinds, arguing all kinds of legal challenges to the war. So we do that already. We say, you know, this war is illegal. But we have to be careful in one sense, because it's not so much because I'm concerned about repression. It's because, as I said at the outset, a lot of soldiers aren't really clear on what they think about all this. They've been to Iraq or Afghanistan. They know the wars. They'd say the war sucks. The war's not being fought right. They're losing buddies, and it's really a morass and a pit. They all feel that. But that doesn't mean they feel that we shouldn't do anything to, quote, stop terrorism, you see. And that's the area where we have to do, you know, we have to do a lot more educating to raise the awareness that this is not about stopping terrorism. Probably counterproductive in terms of that goal.
What do you tell them it's about believe in terror? You think terrorism is a fraud?
I don't think terrorism is a fraud, but I think that you can't, I don't think that what we're doing with 150,000 conventionally armed troops marching through neighborhoods and shooting people is a way effective way to stop terrorism. In fact, I think it fuels terrorism.
60 Minutes had a piece where they followed National Guard troop as they, you know, as they were here in the United States, then they got sent to Iraq, and then they got kept in Iraq. And what was very interesting was some of the soldiers over the course of a year changed their opinion about the war. And there was a father and son, both enlisted in the same troop, and they sat them down, and the son had changed his mind about the war, and he thought they were no longer there for any good purpose. Mm-hmm. And the father still thought they were there for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And so the pseudo-journalist at 60 Minutes said to the father, so, you know, why do you think it's still good that we're here? And he said, because on 9/11, when the president stood before us and said, you join me in fighting terrorism, the nation stood together and said yes. And he said, it would be a long fight. Are you still with me? The nation said yes. He said, it will be a struggle and you will all want to give up. Should we do it? And the nation said yes. And he said, and now here we are doing this and the nation is not behind us and the nation's starting to crumble. Well, what killed me is that this journalist who should know better and who definitely knows better never once challenged this soldier on the idea that 9/11 has anything to do with Iraq.
Well, you know that they get fed propaganda. Just last week, the Republican head of the Senate, what's his name, Boehner, got up and he was talking about how Iraq and terrorism and 9/11 and Iraq, and he actually started to cry on the floor of the Senate and linked the two up.
Let me ask you, Todd, how do you see the future here? Because this war, sadly, the Democrats have their way, is going to be with us much longer than we would like.
I agree with that.
And so how do you see your future as a GI organizer, support person, increasing? What can our listeners do? Is there places they can go to help?
Those are good questions. We went up the drum partly because I knew it was a key military base. It's very important to them, those kinds of units. Its full name is 10th Mountain Light, in brackets, light, kind of like light beer, but spelled differently. And the idea of it is it's a rapid deployment force. Everyone in that unit deploys rapid. They don't use heavy armor. They don't use tanks. They don't use much artillery. It's a rapid deployment. They're designed to go all over the world in 72 hours.
This is the 10th Mountain Brigade?
10th Mountain Division.
Yeah, because they founded Aspen, right? They were skiers.
They were, yeah, one time.
Back in the Second World War. And they founded Aspen Ski Resort, actually.
Right. That's right. They were. They also were at Fort Polk for many years.
Right.
And now they've been consolidated up at Drum. And eventually there's going to be four brigades there, not three. Each brigade has about 3,500 combat soldiers. So the difference between it in a big division like the Big Red One is that everyone in this unit goes to war. This is 11 Bravo. These are infantry units, machine gunners. It's not filled with computer operators and people ride around in trucks. So that means that it's key to the future of their ability to carry on these wars, to win over, if we can, to influence these kinds of soldiers. And what I see so far is we are getting them in. They're open to us. We're getting more of a sense of what's going on the base. And next month, the whole brigade is coming home. The 3rd Brigade is coming home from Iraq next month, and we're planning to try to develop some programs. But you see, again, it's difficult to say. We don't want to say, welcome home heroes, welcome home soldiers, you know, that kind of thing. We want to say, we're glad you're home, and we don't want you to return. And so it's a fine line we're trying to thread there with the families. And so many of the families we meet and talk to, they say about their husbands, I don't want to embarrass him or in any way put him in a position where he has to feel compromised or threatened by my actions. So that's another problem we have, is the fear of retribution. And, you know, it's really interesting about a democracy that people uniformly say that. And you say, well, wait a minute, your husband can have views, you can have views. You have a First Amendment in this country. Aren't we a democracy? And they say, yeah, I know, but there's so many things they can do to Jim or to Joe. And so there's a fear, a pervasive fear on the base of retaliation and retribution for having any opinion that's contrary to, you know, go get them.
Now, do you have former soldiers work in the coffee house?
Yeah, we do. The director up there is a former soldier herself. She was married for many years to a career soldier. And we have volunteers that are, some of them are Vietnam veterans. So that's good. But as I said, we've still got to build in more of our outreach to youth. You know, these are 19 to 20-year-old soldiers now. They're real young, often relatively inexperienced, politically, I would say politically pretty naive. And so we got a lot of work to do to get them to see that these wars and this perpetual deployment is completely against their interests. And I'll be honest with you, I do believe that at some point there has to be a breaking point. You know, you're talking now about people going on their third deployment, and deployments now are 15 months, remember?
Wow.
So this is grueling, grinding. It's worse than Vietnam. It's much
amazing.
Well, Vietnam mostly was 12 months, you came home. This is terrible. And the levels of post-traumatic stress are going to be higher because of the stressors and the fact they're subjected to so much problems with their units. So in a sense, it's worse than ever, and yet in some ways the coherent ideology seems to be stronger than ever. So that's really the challenge for us.
Now, Todd, we'd like to close by sending our listeners to a website. What's your website at Citizen Soldier where people can find out more information?
Absolutely. There are two sites. One, Citizen Soldier. You just need to put a hyphen between citizenandsoldier.org. Otherwise, you'll get a real nutty right-wing group, and you'll know immediately. You'll know immediately you're in the wrong place. Then the drummer has its own website. It's pretty simple. Different Drummer Cafe, all one word, cafe, CAFE.org.
I've been speaking with Todd Enzine, who's the lawyer and director of Citizen Soldier. It's a support organization for GIs. Michael Smith, I think Heidi and myself have known Todd for a very, very long time. He's been at it since, was there a war before Vietnam? I think there was. But you've been at it for a long time.
So Guatemala before.
In 1954, right.
Todd, you do great work, right. And we all respect you, and we send out our support.
Well, thank you.
You know, keep making trouble.
We'll do our best. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Nice
talking. Great.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see, the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new name. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat live about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. Panther power. Go toe-to-toe with the panther and you just can't win. Self-proclaimed best, suppress the rest. The rich get richer and the poor take less. The American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. The Ku Klux Klan tried to keep us out. We signed truth and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for our freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. My mother never let me.
forget my history, hoping I was set free. Chains that were put on me, wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being a statistic. Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government, cause it was meant to hold us back. Using ignorance, drugs, the sneak attack in my community. They killed the unity, but when I charge them, try to claim immunity. I strike America like a case of heart disease. Panther power is running through my arteries. Try to stop me, oh boy, you'll be clawed to death, cause I'll be fighting for my freedom with my dying breath. Do you remember? That's what I'm asking you. You think you're living free? Don't make me laugh at you. Open your eyes, realize you've been locked in chains. Said you wasn't civilized and stole your name. Cause some time has passed, seems to all forget. There is no liberty for you and me. We ain't free yet. Panther power.